Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
What's in a name? Or should I say, what's in a name? We all have heard of Watts Mill in Kansas City, but I bet many just think it's the name of a shopping center around 103rd and State Line. Well, I thought it was that until I chatted with Diane Houston about the name, the history of the area, and what some residents still call it today. Well, a lot of us have seen the name, and we don't really know what it means. I think a lot of times we see that around Kansas City or wherever you live, that you see a name of something, and you just kind of take it for granted that, well, that's just what the name of it is. And, of course, we're talking about Watts Mill. I guess some think it's a shopping center. Some think it's, maybe a part of town, maybe not. But I think we know what it is, but we really don't know why it's called Watts Mill. And there's a great story behind this that shows that basically that was kind of the beginning of the Western frontier in the United States, if you will, back in the old 1800s.
I know. Can you imagine that this location that is what we consider a parking lot and a shopping center now, Watts Mill, was really the center of frontier activity, as the Santa Fe Trail was in its infancy. Kansas City hasn't even really been established. Choteaus are just establishing their trading post in what would be now Kansas City. And here we've got these guys that say, this spot looks like a really great location for a mill, which it is an amazing location. I don't think there's very many people that have been in Kansas City for a period of time who haven't at least seen like the flooding of 103rd Street, right? Mm-hmm. And also how beautiful the location is just to the east of where Jasper's, one of our favorite places to go, where Jasper's is. I mean, there's a waterfall there. So you can imagine what the natural landscape in the valley would have looked like back in the early 1830s. It was a prime location for what started as a sawmill, developed into a grist mill. I mean, it was the place to be seen, and Native Americans were still trapsing around the area. I mean, it's incredible.
You know, I when you're talking about that, I'm closing my eyes and picturing that just in the middle of the wilderness, and Jasper's isn't there, and Price Chopper isn't there, and there's no car dealerships there or anything. Mm-hmm. It just is in the middle, and you could just kind of see that mill, which became so vital to not only to the growth of our country, but to the growth of Kansas City. It was almost like where everybody came and everybody stopped, took care of their business, and went on their way. Why did that become such a big spot and a big part of growth in Kansas City?
Well, let's think about what would have been established during this time period. So the mill, the land is essentially bought in 1832 by two brothers, George and John Fitzhugh.
Now, let me ask you this. Back in that day, who were you buying that land from? You said it
government.
Was bought by two brothers. So the government basically owned everything, and you're just giving them pennies on the dollar.
Yes. So they're going to be the original land deal. So we always look at the original land deals. And then, of course, I always track them through history to see, you know, how ownership works, because back in these days, people were surprisingly mobile. You know, they were going to go to, these guys are coming from usually in this area from, you know, Tennessee, Kentucky, Virginia, they're Southerners. They're actually moving for business purposes. Not everybody wanted to be a farmer. They were looking for the next big thing. So you have a lot of movement, and the Fitzhughs were they were pretty well established, so they had the money to buy this 40 acres where Watts Mill, you know, ended up being, and they looked at this location. They found the waterfall, because you would go out and speculate. It's not like you just went, well, this looks good on a map. Like, you went out there and took a look at the land. It's right on the edge of the frontier. I mean, just on the border of what would be Kansas Territory, which was Indian Territory. We have all these Indian reservations. They haven't even been established yet. So it was a prime location because of the fact that not just pioneers relied on things like grist mills and sawmills. So did Native Americans. So when you have to think about that, you've got the Choteau's trading post in 1822, and then you've got, of course, Fort Osage in the early 1800s is the real first established, you know, trading with the Native Americans, which is where, you know, business and commerce started here. And then, you know, even when this was established, Independence, Missouri was built on the Santa Fe Trail in 1827. And this is 1832. So if you've got these wagon trains that are just coming through in the Santa Fe Trail at the same time period, they're coming through. And the Santa Fe Trail would have gone just to the south of the location of Watts Mill. That's where New Santa Fe would eventually be created. They needed supplies. In, you know, Westport Landing's not even there yet when this mill shows up. So they're going from the Independence, Missouri area, and then they're on their wagon trains heading into the frontier. This is like your last stop. So people would camp there. There's everything that you need. You've got water, obviously. Mm-hmm. You have a chance to mill or get any supplies that you need, and they go off into the frontier. I mean, this is the Wild West.
Well, it's also crazy to me to think about how many different kind of stops along the way there were, mm-hmm. just from Fort Osage to Westport to Watts Mill to, you know, mm-hmm. wherever the case may be. And they're all within like seconds of each other now. I mean, like now, I guess right. back in the day, I mean, that was like a day's journey to go from Westport down to Watts Mill.
Right. And to give you an idea, and it seems like nothing until, you know, you run on the treadmill. We were just talking about this, you know, mm-hmm. and all of that. At this time period, basically from the border or near Independence to the New Santa Fe area is 20 miles. So originally where New Santa Fe was, which is 122nd state line now, right? With New Santa Fe was 20 miles. So it was originally called Blue Camp 20. That's what they called it because that was a place they would stop along the trail. But so you can imagine, and you have to remember, there's no roads. So people, it's not like they're traveling next to each other. You know, they're passing in the left lane. You know, like they're traveling, just going through the countryside. There's not very many farms established. So you can imagine it would be yards. I'm not going to say yards. It would be even further than that. You know, even a half a mile away might be another wagon train, you know, so they're pretty far apart. But settling and making sure people would stop where there were springs and people would stop where there were mills and where they could, you know, trade local goods and what they needed before they would leave. So this was a very important stop. It was important enough that they started to quickly build this mill up. And these two guys, it's kind of interesting. They end up leaving because they're going to look for the next big thing. The Fitzhughes, who have a pretty good place in early Jackson County history, end up settling in Texas. And what did they build? They built a mill. So, I mean, it's like this was just their operation. And the business sold, or I should say the mill itself sold along with the land to a couple Westport merchants in 1842. So, you know, 10 years later. And then it actually sold to Albert Boone, which we know Boone, if you've ever, you know, swayed by Kelly's in Westport, there's a nice Albert Boone information about him. He's the one who built that business.
Is that where Boone's farm comes from?
No. Yeah. You know, no. Absolutely not. But, you know, you've heard of Daniel Boone.
Yeah.
This is Daniel Boone's descendant, direct descendant. So Albert Boone operated a trading post or trading store out of Westport. He went into the milling business, if you will. He probably rented it out, right? And then again, it sold for the final time in 1850 to a guy named Anthony Benaw Watts. And he came from St. Charles, Missouri. And he had a milling background. So he starts milling there. He's got his family and all of this. He has experience. And then he's got competition. So, you know, at this time, 1850, right, there's more people around. There's more settlements. But people still needed a mill. And he had competition with a guy named Ezra Hickman, as in Hickman Mills. I love that people don't realize that it was originally called Hickman's Mill. You know, like Watts is plural mill. Mm-hmm. And showing possession. And it was, they said when they established their post office, somebody screwed up. And that's how it became Hickman Mills that we call it today.
Didn't that happen with Lee's Summit too?
Yep.
Something like that?
Yes.
Like, so why on the Missouri side did they not understand like apostrophes?
I always think that there might be something with a little bit of phonetics too in the way people pronounce things at the time. Uh-huh. I mean, these are your Southerners. I mean, everything came with an accent. I mean, half of the quotes that I find from some of these old pioneers, I can't help but do with like a really good twang with them because, yeah, you know, that's how it was said.
Sure.
You know, like the Rebs, you know, right. and fellas, you know, you just know that it wasn't, people just talked, you know, phonetically, sorry about that. They talked phonetically and talked in the way that they actually were saying. So I think it's just interesting to think about that time period. So he had a son. And, you know, I love names. Maybe it's just that they had so many kids that they just, you know, ran out of options. I'm not sure. Names his kid Stubbins. I love it. And that's another one. Was it Stebbins or Stubbins? It's spelled both ways. It's most commonly, and I always go to the headstone. You figure that, you know, the family's going to be the one to spell it the way they want it spelled. And it really is most recognized as Stubbins Watts. So Stubbins was born in 1838. He's the fifth kid of Anthony. He's basically grown up, right? Milling and all of that. But he worked as a freighter on the Santa Fe Trail. And of course, he had to go serve with the Reb. You know, he had to go into the rebel army, to the Confederacy, and go fight for 4 years. This guy was, if you've seen pictures of him, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this guy's like, exactly. Oh,
he looks like a Stubbins, you know? Yeah.
He does. I mean, yeah. You can't even make it up. I mean, it's like, he's the coolest looking dude ever. I want to sit down and talk to this guy.
Yeah.
He's awesome. His father actually dies at the beginning of the Civil War in 1861. So the mill probably wasn't being operated while he was away, when Stebbins was away. He comes back and of course he gets married, and I love it. He gets married barefoot, like right outside the mill. Real romantic. What a beautiful backdrop though, right?
No kidding though. You're talking about like real romantic, and I'm thinking about this beautiful old mill along a river with a waterfall,
right.
And like,
I know.
It really is a nice setting.
It is. I mean, and I love it because he was really in that area, the house, and people always ask me, where was the house? You know, where's this? Where's that? You know, and I can only about estimate, and I have some pictures of the old house too. And the house was built by his father, and it was just west of the mill. And again, your boundaries are a little different. You can imagine flooding. So it would have been on the higher ground, real near the car dealerships is what I was going to tell people. But, so they have their kids, they have three kids, and, you know, they're known to have big celebrations. The mill was always a gathering place. So even, you know, people always went down there. It was like, oh, I'm going to go with my dad on the wagon ride to go turn this corn and blah, 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 and see all my friends. I mean, it was a real deal to go to the mill. And, you know, they were known to have Christmas parties that lasted all the way into the night and all of this. And I'm like, oh, this sounds like so much fun. And they're seven people fiddling. Of course, they play the fiddle,
sure.
Right? I mean, again, Stubbins plays the fiddle. Of course,
well,
he does.
It's also the 1800s, you know?
I know. Yeah. And some of the song titles are hysterical, like, you know, Fittin' Britches. I'm like, I don't know. I don't know what that means. But it's really cool. They have these parties into the night. And what also happens, which is interesting with the area, is that Watts Mill kind of ends up being the center of activity, which of course makes real estate more important around it. And so a town develops there. And this is going to be at the turn of the century in the early 1900s. The town of Dallas, Missouri, mm-hmm. is founded there. And there was a post office there for years and such. And a lot of businesses that were on 103rd Street, houses along 103rd Street. The last one was destroyed more recently than you would even believe. It just became a settlement area. And so so Stubbins ends up being known as the Fiddlin' Miller of Dallas, Missouri. So Stubbins is the Fiddlin' Miller. And there's a real common photo of him holding his fiddle, looking all old with this big old beard and probably doesn't have any teeth. I'm sorry. I'm pretty sure he doesn't have any teeth. You know, he's amazing. That photo is really commonly hung in the area around Watts Mill today. I always laugh when I walk into a location and people take, you know, homage to Stubbins Watts. Southside Bar has a big picture of them. I know that Ugly Joe's has a picture of them. So these restaurants and bars, you know, put his picture up. And even in the 1960s, there was an old business, an old restaurant there on 103rd Street that was called the Indian Creek Inn. And one of the people, longtime residents of Dallas, Missouri, said, if Aunt Kate and Uncle Stubbins knew their picture was hanging in the entrance of the Indian Creek Inn, they would turn over in their graves. And the reason she said that is that Stubbins and his wife were dry. These guys didn't drink. So I started thinking, I'm like, all night parties without whiskey?
Yeah.
I mean, like, wow. But people, they have, you know, you're going to listen to your hosts, obviously. So apparently they would turn over in their graves if they knew that their photo was hanging in a bar. So next time you go down to Southside or whatnot, you grab a cocktail, go up and you know, cheers that photo of Stebbins Watts.
Well, it's really kind of comical about how things start, and you look back as to where we are right now, and you look at Watts Mill and you think of, oh, okay, Fuzzy South, now Ugly Joe.
Yeah.
You know, you think of Southside, you think of Jasper's, you think of like all the places that are 103rd Street Tavern now moving up. Coaches back in the day used to
be. How about Gomer's is going in now?
Oh,
like,
is
right
it?
There. Yes.
Okay, Gomer's going in right now. Also, like I said, Coaches 103rd, all that stuff that's now there and has been for a very long time. You have to think of yourself, well, what started as kind of a party point is still a party point to this day. I mean,
right.
So you wonder why Fuzzy South was there. Well, people were partying to all ends of the night back in the 1800s, maybe they were playing the fiddle and dancing at that point in time. But this point in time, people are drinking and playing the fiddle and dancing until all hours.
Exactly. I know. It's kind of a nice homage. I just think it's funny that even in the 1960s, as Dallas was really its own little community down there, they even recognize like, I don't know if he liked that, his picture. But then I'm thinking Stebbins was kind of that character just from some of the quotes and the information I've learned about him that, you know, would be all right with the fame, you know?
Yeah,
kind of
sure.
Like, you kind know, like I think it. Yeah, I think he likes, I mean, how many pioneers were there back in the day? And your name is etched in Kansas City history now. Like,
yeah.
How cool is that? I mean, I'm pretty sure he'd be all right with it.
Kind of like a precursor to Jerry Anselmo, you know?
In whose brain? No, I'm just kidding.
Well, exactly. So, you know, there's a couple of things that I definitely want to touch on. First mm-hmm. and foremost, when we look at, you know, the Watts Mill area, and you mentioned Dallas, Missouri, the first thing that came to my mind when I was reading about it all is, when did Dallas disappear and why did it disappear? Why don't we keep that and celebrate that more,
right,
as opposed to just like basically getting rid of it now? Because I would imagine you ask 9 out of every 10 Kansas City residents where Dallas, Missouri is, and they're going to tell you in the Boot Heel or by Joplin or
there's
up
a Dallas
north.
County, Missouri. So a lot of people equate when they hear Dallas, Missouri, they're going to assume that you're talking about Dallas County, Missouri, which
yeah,
is nowhere
so
near
like,
here.
Like from our standpoint, when did that all like basically disappear where we don't have any more kind of history of Dallas, Missouri?
There were a lot of old businesses. You're going to get, I always say a blacksmith shop is always what turns into the modern day, gas station, you know, and a place that you get your car fixed, you know, just a straight up mechanic. Mm-hmm. And they had those businesses along there. That's not, those things were established. And something when a town is platted, right, a town is platted into its different lots. You're not buying, you know, 40 acres, you know, and all of that, like the early Fitzhughes did. You have those lots that kind of stay connected, which is part of the reason that it was easy to divide those lots into what would become car dealerships down there. It started with one car dealership. That's all it took. There was an old guy, and we're going to have to talk about this again later because it's a whole different story, but there's an old family that lived down in Watts Mill forever, and it was the last house standing. And so if you were driving down 103rd Street today, it'd be about halfway in between Wardle and State Line. And it would be on the north side of the street. And there was an old farmhouse there. I remember it. Like, it's not like it was torn down that long ago. It was in the 90s. It was torn down. And the family held on to it. They, like, held on for dear life. Like, this is Dallas, Missouri. This is it. This is it. We're holding on to this house. We're holding on to it. And the car dealership's like, all right, cool. They're building up all around them. And so they made a deal, like, I think it was in the 70s or 80s, made a deal, hey, you guys can, you know, you stay here, whatever, but will you please let us buy your property, you know, when you pass? Sure. He ends up living into like his late 90s. So that's how it ended up staying in this family for as long as it did. And it was the Bill Crotty was his name. And he recently passed away, and he was a real historian, and he grew up in Dallas, Missouri. And I was blessed to talk to him several times and have a recorded interview with him. I haven't even begun to do much with for Dallas, Missouri, because I know it's one of those locations that people don't know. But like I said, you have to remember, as the city moved south, we annexed. So, I mean, and that's actually ended up being, in my opinion, a little bit of a negative to Kansas City versus what happened in like Johnson County, because you have the established Leawood stayed Leawood, Overland Park stayed Overland Park, you know? In Kansas City, as it moved south, started annexing in. That Hickman Mills didn't happen until the 1960s. Yeah. You know, so Hickman Mills used to be its own post office. New Santa Fe, Martin City, Dallas, Missouri, all of those things got absorbed by Kansas City. When you absorb and you change your name, and we've talked about name changes, and when you change your name, you lose a piece of that pie in that piece of history. And the people that remember it for what it was aren't, you know, they end up moving away. They don't like the traffic. They, you know, they grew up in farmland. They don't want to be a part of Kansas City. That's how things change. And it takes special people. They've done a great job in Martin City to kind of hold on to that. Car dealerships changed that area. Flooding changed that area. Even though it was prime real estate, you can't stop flooding. And as the Kansas City developed and Johnson County developed, all of that water in Indian Creek, right? More runoff, more flooding. It's not like it flood. The way we have it flood today is not how it flooded back in the 1800s. Mm. There was a lot more land to absorb that thing, you know, unlike what we have today.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's kind of what happens to old towns. It's sad. But there's not very many pictures showing the old town of Dallas, but we can kind of picture what it looked like by looking at the plat and looking at who bought what and what their business interests were.
You mentioned, you know, Hickman starting his mill. What was the rivalry like between Watts Mill and Hickman's mill?
Well, there was no rivalry in the end because essentially, and I didn't mention this earlier, Fitzhugh was even pioneering enough that he imported stones from France to actually have the millstones be really good quality, which is going to already put them above the competition in and of itself. And Ezra Hickman, he built a grist mill and it's 5 miles away. So Anthony expands his mill. It's like, oh, you're going to build that? I'm going to build one bigger, you know? So that's how that happened. And Hickman Mills never had anywhere near the competition because they were just off the beaten path. So Hickman's mill was going to be operating more as a local mill, whereas Stebbins Mill and Watts Mill and what we would call Fitzhugh Watts Mill really developed more because it was also a pioneer mill. It was gonna pick up that traffic from people moving. And they did business with Native Americans really early on. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of a cool piece as well.
Back in the day, and this is again totally off track, but you made me think of something. If you wanted to import something from France, like would that take like a year by the time you wrote a letter and got a response? Uh-huh. And what was that process? Like that couldn't have been an easy deal.
Couldn't have been easy at all. I mean, it's all about who you know. So, you know, I don't even know. How do you know that? You've never been to France. How do you know that they're better in France? Like, I have so many questions. I mean, you have to remember Fitzhughs and things like that. These are Southern pioneers. They'd never been to France, but you know, they knew from their experience in the industry that those were the stones that were the best for the business. And I'm sure out of the East Coast and through business, you know, different operatives, they're all going to get a piece of the money, right? They got those stones there, but I can't imagine like how they freighted them that way. I mean, I have no idea. You don't have no railroads. So everything's going to be by water, probably. Mm-hmm. Unbelievable. It's really hard to know. I mean, but even early on.
And really remarkable that they were able to pull something like that off back then.
Right. I mean, it's not like it weighed a little bit. Right. I know. Yeah. It's kind of like looking at Stonehenge. Like, how did they do that? I can't answer directly. I just know that even in the early time of Kansas City, you know, people built homes. They just built them the way they're going to build them. You know, there were standard ways to build it, like dog trot style and all of these different types of log cabins. And even before brick housing, they were importing houses on steamboats that were like pre-assembled, like what we would call like track housing or like, you know, buy your house online, like Sears and Roebuck catalog. Mm-hmm. They had that in the 1820s and 30s. I mean, it was even a thing then. And so some of the early houses that went up in Kansas City were actually made and assembled in pieces in Cincinnati, Ohio. I mean, the stuff that happened is pretty amazing. I mean, I think we don't give them enough credit for how resourceful that they were at the time. And I just love, I mean, there's so much history in that area too. And it's hard to imagine that Watts Mill, they of course had a family cemetery. You know, people, of course, always ask me, like, is it still there? I'm like, well, I mean, no, but could pieces still be there? Sure. But in any case, they had a Watts family burial ground. It was at 101st and Jefferson. So, I mean, just north of the old coaches and in between, you know, it's on the hill overlooking Indian Creek. And, you know, of course, Anthony was buried there. And I think it's cool that the neighbor, of course, that real, actually pretty famous neighbor was Jim Bridger, the old mountain man, Jim Bridger with his Indian wives. I mean, you know, one of Jim Bridger's wives died on the Blue River. And so he just buried her there. Just left her, said a quick service or whatever.
Yeah.
Escaped out. But I mean, it's just a different era. It's just a different time period. And Native Americans wouldn't have had like funeral, obviously, what we would have. But in any case, Jim Bridger lived an amazing life. And in his older age, he was totally blind, which was super sad. But he lived right by where St. Joseph Hospital would be today. Just north. I mean, it was the next farm over from the Watts family. And, you know, he was always gone as a lot when he was, you know, pioneering in frontier days and doing what he was doing. But he was super good friends with Stebbins Watts, and they were very far apart in age. So it would probably have been like a father-son relationship. And so, you know, he asked, can I be buried in your family cemetery? It's like, sure. And I mean, Jim Bridger was at Stebbins Watts' house when he died. Mm. So he passes away. He's blind as can be. So they, you know, have a ceremony, whatever. He's buried up at 101st and Jefferson. And he really doesn't, we had a real love of the Wild West in the 1880s, 1890s, and then at the turn of the century. You know, it became cool to play cowboys and Indians. Like those types of things happened. And so there's a renewed love of that frontier pioneering spirit. And so it was 1904 when a group, I should say, decided that Jim Bridger needed an actual cool burial spot that people like would go and see, because he was really, you know, important. He's got a statue in Westport, for crying out loud. Super important dude. So they dug him up and they moved him to Mount Washington Cemetery and erected this beautiful grave and all of this for him. And so, you know, they dug him up. And so Edgar Watts, who was Stubbins' son, and he was the next miller, one of the millers, you know, he's there and he's got to put the, you know, dirt back where the casket used to be.
Yeah.
And he finds a jawbone, like Jim Bridger's jawbone, buried in 1881. He's like, huh. Like, what would you do if you found a jawbone? Well, I mean, I know you'd probably come home and be like, Jen, cool, look at what I just found. But wouldn't you, like, turn it in or something? Wouldn't you?
I think maybe I just throw dirt on top of it and fill it back in. I don't know.
What I know. I'd be like, oh, I'm going to. And you know they would have known what a human jawbone and, like, animal jawbone look like. It's, you know, I mean, this is, like, normal for them. And I mean, not that we wouldn't recognize a human jawbone today. But he's like, puts it in his pocket, takes it home, and doesn't tell anybody. You have Jim Bridger's jawbone in your pocket. So Edgar doesn't say anybody to anybody. And then his dad passes away, which is kind of a sad thing. And so Stubbins Watts, he lives well into his 80s. So the photographs we have of him are like when he's like super old and like the mill is barely, you know, it's surviving and all this. 62 years that dude worked at that mill. 62 years. And he dies in 1922. So Stubbins, and he had moved his family burial plot because he knew he could see what was happening. He knew that it wouldn't be long before things absorbed into his community. So they moved to the whole Watts family to Stanley, Kansas. So Stubbins is buried in Stanley, Kansas. Son Edgar's there, you know, at the funeral. Takes out the jawbone, Jim Bridger's jawbone. Throws it into the ground.
Oh my.
Buries it with Stubbins. And his reason for doing it, I love this. He said, well, they laughed and talked together, so it seemed the fitting thing to do. All right. So if you go to Stanley, Kansas, there's a millstone actually at the Watts Mills burial plot in this cemetery. You can just imagine, well, part of Jim Bridger's here too. It's just bizarre, but I love it. I love that story. Well, they talk so much, they might as well just be close together now. Like, that's amazing.
My. All right, before we wrap this up, and I think we need to address this. Why isn't Kansas City considered the gateway to the West when we had all of these outposts and final places to stop before people truly did go West?
Yeah, that's a great question.
Thank you.
I know. Why don't we have the arch?
I don't even know that we need the arch, but I think we need the because if you're really studying history, and I know Lewis and Clark and all that happened and whatnot, But when you really think about it, all the pioneers, all the wagon trains, everybody that was heading west, really your last stop on the frontier was here before you went to who knows where, wherever you ended up.
It's true. We are definitely, I think when you think pioneer, and I think that's the key word here, the pioneer frontier that we know and love and envision in this time, in this era, it really is this side of the state. It's this side of the city, this side of the state, this area specifically where we are, is the gateway to the West. But when you look at the earlier history, the stuff that we kind of breeze over, the earlier history, and you got Louisiana Purchase, all of that stuff, and those first modern, what we call modern city and development, the gateway of, you know, I say to the West, or however you want to put it, that really did get its birth in St. Louis. And the Choteaus, right? Like the Choteau family, their prominence in St. Louis. So you have that active trading happening along the Mississippi River, not the Missouri River. So you're talking about the gateway of, and rivers were so important. I mean, how do you think Lewis and Clark got around, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I struggle with this a lot because I think when we think of frontier and pioneering, we're thinking 1800s. When we're talking about founding and the development of the United States and kind of that idea of moving west, and I mean more in the 1700s into the 1800s, you're looking at more of the St. Louis area. So it's like, I think that it's going to be a natural rivalry then between the two sides of the state. It's like, who did it better? Who are the real pioneers?
No matter how long you've lived in Kansas City, you can always learn something new about our town. I hope this episode of Two States and One Story taught you something new. I know it did for me.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.